All right. Welcome back to another episode of Business Partner Partners. I'm Chrissy.
I'm Ryan.
And today we have a very special couple on. We have Joan and William Herlong from Joan Herlong and Associates with Sotheby's International Realty. Welcome.
You added the syllable.
No, that's I didn't. Right. I said realty.
That's all good.
She added a preposition, but that's okay.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
I nailed it.
We're happy to be here.
We're glad to have you guys.
It was a micro syllable.
Yeah.
Micro.
Just, it was there, though.
All right. So as our first realtor's on, we want to know all about what you're doing, how you work together. And so we've sent y'all some questions, but we're going to go ahead and just start with the hard hitters.
Okay.
So the first one being... Tell us about how you met and how long you've been together.
Let's hear his version.
Okay.
My version? Well, we were in college. I was, and I went to a dorm mixer, and there was this really cute girl there. And,
hoping it was you.
Too.
I know.
Me too.
I was waiting for it.
Badoom.
And she was busy, so.
too predictable, too predictable.
And so I started a conversation with her.
No, you didn't. No, absolutely. He's already incorrect.
Well, actually, I ignored her at first and walked across the room and got a beer and came back and she stopped me. And you want to tell the story that way?
Mm-hmm. It was the third day of our first year at the University of Virginia. We were in the same dorm and there was a mixer. And it was in the basement of the dorm. And he walked in and sort of surveyed the room. And I turned to a girl next to me, and I said, "Who is that guy?" And she goes, "I think he's an RA. He must be an RA because he seems to know what he's doing.
He looks really important.
He must be an RA because he walked in, and he went and got himself a beer and left. And then about, I don't know, 30 minutes later, whatever, he came back. And that time, he did not survey the room. He just was making his way over to the keg. And this time, I turned to her, and I said, "Who does that guy think he is?" Because he had this...
See, I could hear her thinking all this,
oh, yeah.
And I knew I had her.
And he was wearing a t-shirt that said Sea Island, Georgia on it. And I walked over to him, and I said, "Do you go to Sea Island?" And he looked at me like, "You are the dumbest girl." And then he realized he was wearing, and he said, "Yes, once." And I was like, "Okay, well." And then He did pour me a beer, and
Gentlemen.
Then we were sort of standing around in a circle. I have a photogenic memory. We were standing around in a circle, and you know, it was inane conversation. Like, what floor are you on? What are you majoring in? And somebody said to William, "What floor do you live on in the dorm?" And he said, "First." And then under his breath, so that only I could hear it, he said, "Naturally."
Actually, I said, "Of course."
Do you remember
yeah.
acting like
I
that?
I remember it with precision. I said, "Of course."
Yeah, and I went, "Bleh." I was like, "Bleh."
And
which
I knew
is the
I knew
exact
I had her.
Reaction
you
that you wanted.
Actually, what's really funny about all this is 5 years later, we're getting married, and her best friend was at the rehearsal.
My best friend since first grade.
Yeah, was there and pulls out a letter.
We don't have to talk about this part.
I think we do
but
now.
No, go ahead.
And pulls out and reads a letter that Joan had written to her very soon, a couple
about
weeks
after. About
a week
after.
And, you know, talked about me and said, "I think I'll marry him." And then I'm sitting there at the rehearsal dinner, and I'm really overwhelmed with this thought that I actually thought I had something to do with this. And I realized I didn't have anything to do.
Yeah, I did. I wrote a letter to her about a week or two after meeting him, and I said, "And I will marry him, yes."
So how did it go from, like, "You are so cocky and annoying" to "I would like to marry you"?
Those two things are not mutually exclusive, and they are still going on.
I am not cocky.
Just annoying.
It was, I would say it was a tumultuous relationship for about 5 years. And then
well, you guys can probably all think about somebody that you knew about that age where the couple, they were always fussing and arguing and, you know, whatever. We were that couple.
We were.
We were.
Wow. Yeah.
Were y'all your friends like, y'all need to cut it out?
No, our friends were like, when we announced we're getting married years later, they're like, "Duh."
Duh. Yeah. We dated actually, he dumped me Right before Christmas. Right before Christmas, our fourth year, he dumped me.
It was a moratorium.
And then we went to the movies.
A moratorium.
Which made absolutely no sense. Moratorium. And then we got back together after that Christmas vacation. And
no,
then,
we got back together in about 36 hours.
No. And then we also had a have a nice life moment at the airport after graduation because he was going into the Peace Corps for 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And then he changed his mind about that, too. Well, I suppose I changed his mind about that.
I did.
And we got married a year after graduation.
Well, the funny thing, to take this all in a real serious direction, we did date all the way through college, and it was made college really special. And what's, you know, many things about that are neat, but one of the really neatest things is that all our college friends are mutual friends.
Yeah.
Which is really nice.
That's fun.
And, but, you know, take it to the next level, you know, we're 18 years old when we meet, and you know,
like children.
You're really young, and you know, you meet the person who really is, you know, the person for you. And you're pretty darn young.
Yeah.
Listen to this romance.
And here
That's
you are.
That's really sweet. So how many years have y'all been married?
How many years,
this
William?
This is a test.
Joan's just staring at William.
It'll be 42 this summer.
Wow.
Doesn't seem a day longer than 41.
Congrats.
And four kids.
Four kids,
all four married, and six grandchildren.
Wow.
And they all live within 20 minutes or less of our home.
Man.
That's amazing.
That's pinch me good luck.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, it really is good luck. I mean, we didn't do anything to create that. It's just really good luck.
Well, they all moved away, as they do.
As we do.
As we expected them to.
Sure.
And then one by one, they all moved back along with having children and getting married and all that.
Nice.
Yeah, it's wonderful, actually.
That's cool. So talk to us a little bit about, y'all have both kind of had winding paths to working together. And the reason we have y'all on is because you are married and you work together, but that has not always been the case. So if y'all can kind of take turns and give us like a short career path talk about what you did that has kind of led you up to where y'all are now.
You want me to start that?
Sure.
Well, you know, like we said, we met in college and we got married a year out of college. And then I went to law school up in Chicago. Joan had a job there.
I supported our eating habit.
Yeah, she handled the eating habit part because I didn't have any money.
Oh, he got a scholarship to Northwestern.
I was on scholarship there at Northwestern. And it was very hard, worked very hard in law school and so forth. But, you know, at the end of it, I took a job with a clerk for a judge for a year in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then worked for a big law firm in Washington, D.C. for 3 years, and so we lived in D.C. And
we had our first child in law school.
Okay. Yeah, Jack was born right before exams, second year of law
Perfect
school.
Perfect timing.
End of second year of law school. Yeah, I skipped all my classes the third year skipped all my classes Thursday and Friday and took care of Jack.
Yeah, we had a nice lady who came in Monday through Wednesday, and William had Jack Thursday and Friday.
Yeah, it was kind of wonderful, actually.
Yeah, it was.
I would never have been as comfortable with, you know, babies and kids if I hadn't done that. So anyway, lived in Washington, D.C. for 3 years. And then in 1989, when our son Jack was about to start preschool, we were like, this is really not where we want to raise our family. You know, it's a cool place. I love D.C., but not really where. So we moved to Greenville. We looked around
but
a lot.
At that time, we had two toddlers and an infant.
Yeah, and we looked around a number of places, and we got a great opportunity in Greenville, and we came here. And I worked at the law firm for really right at 10 years, trying a lot of cases. I was a trial attorney and doing contracts and deals. Did all that for about 10 years, and then in 1999, I left and joined a client in the .com world, doing technology, general counsel stuff, but a lot more than that. It was a startup, and then that didn't go anywhere. And, you know, put my tail between my legs and went back into the practice of law with a very big firm, Nelson Mullins, some people probably heard of. And then in 2004, I went out on my own with a good buddy, Scott Anderson, and we were partners for a couple of years. And then Scott had a great opportunity somewhere else, so I was on my own and then just solo practitioner kind of thing. And at the same time, Joan in Chicago was working at the ad agency, big ad agency. I'll turn it back to you for that.
Well, you didn't get to the part where we started working together.
Well, okay, you're right. Anyway, so I'm on my own. And
as in
I,
answering the question.
I take on a very big case in 2007, which ended up lasting 7 years.
Wow.
And it ended well, but it was a very, very challenging case. Went on for a long time. And in the end, had a good result, but I was very beat up. And then I ended up taking another very big case on. And after that, probably 2016 or 17, I was just kind of like, I think I want to chill out on the legal side for a while.
Sure.
And can I help you? And I had been helping her sort of in the background for years, you know, with things where I could. But this was more overt, and I got, you know, more literally involved in the company like I am now.
Okay.
Cool.
Wow. I do want to ask a question that's kind of unrelated. And I don't know if you can say, like, what types of cases last 7 years?
Biblical ones.
If you sue a billionaire, that's a good possibility that that case will last.
Okay.
Wow.
Because they want to.
And I brought a class action, derivative action against a billionaire.
Oh, wow.
And he threw everything imaginable.
Yeah.
Luckily, it was all during the recession, so it didn't bother us at all financially.
Yeah.
It was absolutely stress-free.
Well, there were many things about that case where we were incredibly lucky, and probably the biggest thing of all was that I handled it by myself for 2 years, but then I brought in some other lawyers, and they were fantastic.
Nice. Mm. Wow.
And we just had a great working relationship, and that was critical.
Yeah.
I can see how you would get burnt out in that situation.
Well, I referred to it as the bridge case because I called it the bridge case because if he had not prevailed, we would be living under a bridge today.
I had space reserved Hollis Bridge, right around the corner.
We were in debt.
I don't think you have to reserve it.
No, we were in debt up to our eyeballs.
Wow.
It is a very expensive thing to
Well, one of the things about litigation, being a lawyer, and if you take on a giant case like that, you can't just take it on and then after a while go, oh, never mind.
You yeah, know, right.
You're in it.
As a lawyer I once knew described it, he said, you're in the boat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Okay, so Joan, take us to Chicago. You're working at an ad agency. William gave us the teaser.
My first job out of college was at CNN in Atlanta. Mm. And that lasted 6 months. I thought I wanted to be the next Baba Wawa. Barbara Walters, remember?
Oh yeah.
But then 6 months at CNN changed my mind about that.
Yeah.
And I had a job that started in that following March in Chicago at Leo Burnett Advertising.
Oh yeah.
And I was in their client service training program. And let's see, I started in March, we got married in July. I was at Leo Burnett for 3 years. And what's really interesting, it couldn't happen today, but because I became pregnant with Jack during my second year law school, they looked at me and said, well, you can't do client service as a
wow.
pregnant person. Like, that doesn't look good. And so they switched me to media. I became a media supervisor, and there I was, 24 years old, and had three people working for me, which was pretty sweet.
Yeah. Can you imagine, though, someone at an ad agency tried to tell a pregnant woman that
Not
now?
Not today.
No.
But, yeah. And so then we moved to Charlotte, and in Charlotte, we had a toddler, and I was pregnant with our second. And I was the media department for a little bitty ad agency. I don't think it exists anymore. It was Kothy, Howard, and Roach. And I was working part-time, like half of every day.
Okay.
And that was pretty terrible. I found out that working part-time is the worst of both worlds because you don't have reliable child care.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pregnant with our second during that. And the guy who worked across the hall from me would touch my stomach every day. Every day, I'd say, oh, you're even bigger this week.
No.
Oh, my gosh.
And finally, I said, I would go like this, and finally I said, why don't you move your hands up, and we'll both get more out of this.
You did not say that to him.
Of course I did. And he was like, you're terrible. I was like, yeah, but he never touched me again, so
yeah.
That was a good thing. And then...
That's a move. That's a move.
But that was also the 80s.
Yeah.
Men
yeah.
felt entitled to touch whatever.
Yeah.
So anyway, then Darcy was born, and we moved to Washington, D.C., where William was working for a white shoe law firm. And at that time, because working part-time was so difficult from a childcare standpoint, I said, look, I don't care if we have to eat nothing but macaroni and cheese and can't afford meat. I want to stay home for a while. Yeah. And he never questioned.
Well, you started freelance writing.
In Washington, though.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. He never questioned whether I wanted to work full-time, part-time. He sort of just let me make that call.
Let?
Yeah.
I question your choice of work.
Well, anyway, then Washington, D.C. is sort of the capital of all these different trade associations. Mm-hmm. And I somehow stumbled into freelance writing for trade publications. And then I became a columnist for the National Restaurant Association, and I was a columnist for the IGA Grocergram. And it was great. It was sort of mad money for me. It wasn't, I remember somebody saying to me, well, can you fax that over? And I was like, I could microwave it. But I mean, I didn't have a home office. I didn't have, it was just mad money. It kept me sane.
Yeah.
And then we had our third child in Washington, and that's also when Jack had just turned 5, and during that time we decided we're going to start looking for someplace else. And William is from a little bitty town in South Carolina. Never ever thought he would come back to South Carolina, but his sister and brother-in-law had interviewed with a very prestigious law firm here, and they said, you need to go and talk to the Weitch firm. And that's what brought us to Greenville. And so when we moved here, we had 2 toddlers and a baby, and I was still at home. And then we had our 4th child 3 years after that in 1992. And as much as I wanted 4 children, I did not like being underestimated. Because when you have 4 children and you go to a social event with your spouse who is a successful attorney and you're talking to all these other attorneys and professionals, they look at you and say, what do you do? I'm like, well, I'm raising 4 kids. And they look beyond me to see if they could find somebody with a brain. And of course, you're forced to volunteer for everything with the PTA, which is, I wanted to do that. But I needed something more. And my mother was in real estate, which meant that I had absolutely no interest in going into real estate. But it was the one thing that I could think of where I could have my own hours, know what my kids looked like, what they were doing. I wouldn't have to get permission from anybody to go to a dentist appointment or to a parent-teacher conference, and I could make some real money. And that was important to me. And to this day, I think people treat that as sort of a vulgar statement for a woman to make. But I certainly didn't go into it because I really like houses and I love people. I wanted to go and work for myself. So, but I thought I could do it part-time.
Yeah, you're kind of underselling it. I mean, Joan has, it's really funny. And I remember noting this long before she went into real estate. And I forget what it was, but we went to to New York for some reason. And so we fly into LaGuardia. And LaGuardia was a mess. And, you know, there's no Uber or anything like that. We find a taxi and we're taking a taxi into town. And by the time we get from the airport to the hotel, Joan knows everything there is to know about the driver. How many brothers and sisters he have, where the little town he's from, all these things. And I was like, this is somebody who tunes into people.
Yeah.
Well, I already knew all about that about William, so there's nobody else to talk to in the cab.
Yeah, but whereas I'm sitting in the back, you know, just sort of in my own little world, she's there, you know, whatever. And I think that same, I don't know what you call it, but openness or whatever, friendliness or whatever you want to call it, it's perfect for being a real estate agent for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Right.
So do you like people in houses?
That's a bad question to ask.
Sure. Houses are fine. You know, it's a commodity. I'm an expert in housing.
Right.
But, you know, you don't ask somebody with an orange grove if they love oranges.
I know. I'm just asking because you said, I didn't get into it because I like people or houses.
The reason I say that is because I've lost count of how many coffees I've had with people who are thinking about going into real estate. And I ask, why are you interested? I really like houses a lot.
Yeah.
Just love looking at Pinterest. And I love people. I'm really a people person. And I'm like, you're going to die. You're not going to survive a year in this. If you don't go in it as a business,
right,
you're going to get your feelings hurt. You're going to get kicked around. It's a tough business. Yeah. It is a very tough business. And I'm a little bit competitive, so I like that part of it. And so when I went into it, our youngest was 1 and our oldest was 9. And I thought, well, I'm going to do this part-time. And I worked for C. Dan Joyner, which was the, and I think still is, the largest real estate company in town. And after about a month, I said to my broker, you said that I could do this part-time. And that's not working out.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you can't, but that's a you problem. That's your personality.
Hmm.
And, but once I realized, yeah, I'm doing this full time, then we got a full time nanny. And, even though that meant being kicked out of a couple of carpools, seriously.
Wow.
And well, at that time, there was a much stronger dichotomy between working mothers and mothers who were staying at home.
Yes.
And there was a little bit of static. One of the women that I knew through the Junior League, when I told her that I was, that I'd gotten my real estate license, she said, well, isn't that interesting? Well, good luck, because you know, I cannot imagine buying a house from you, but good luck to you. Good for you.
I cannot imagine buying a house.
I cannot imagine that, but good for you. Yeah, there's this myth out there that Southern women are like super nice. Oh my God, no.
Oh, bless their hearts.
Oh my God, when we first moved here, there were so many times that I said to William, "This is not going to last." I'm from the Chicago area.
Yeah.
I guess you picked that up from my accent, but I was at a junior league meeting, and it was my job. I don't think we'd been here 6 months. It was my job to take the minutes during this meeting, and try doing that when there's 16 women talking to one another and there's wine involved. And I kept interrupting to sort of because they would change the subject like the wind. So I had to interrupt and say, can I just recap? Is this what you're saying? And they're like, yeah. So then, and they were trying to decide about whether they wanted the officers of the organization to be voted on individually or as a slate. And they had decided that it was going to be a slate. So I interrupted them. I said, so let me make sure I've got this right. What you're saying is that you want to just put together a slate that's sort of a fait accompli and people just vote up or down. And this one woman, who shall remain nameless, stood up and she said, you know, that's about the third $50 word that you've used in the last hour, and I'm getting real tired of it. And she said it with a big smile on her face.
Yeah.
And today,
but not that it hurt Joan's feelings or
that I carry a grudge about it today, right? Today, if somebody said that,
she can't even remember
it. That was a hard time recalling that story.
Well, yeah, but you know, today if somebody said that to me, I'd be like, what were the first two?
Yeah.
But I just crumpled. I mean, I couldn't get home fast enough, and I called William, and I was like, this isn't going to work. I was devastated. That was a really mean thing to say.
Yeah.
And it's not like, and I was never talking about, well, this is the way we did it up north.
Right.
I'm not that type. But it's sort of like they made it very clear that I could not assume anything. There was another junior league meeting where they had us go around and talk about why we were joining the junior league. And I said, well, you know, to meet people and make friends. And another woman said, well, good luck with that. I've got more friends than I need as it is. I'm like, okay then. You know,
well, it is kind of funny to think back, because, you know, now we are where we are in life and our children are grown. And if you look, you think, oh, that's just obvious. Did this, mm-hmm. this is progression. And each one of those points in the progression had some very problematic, very challenging things. Joan's telling you these very personal things, but you know, I had comparable things in the jobs that I took on that were very difficult. And frankly, probably everybody does. If you go into their life and their backstory and the, you know, the potholes and the curveballs that they've had to live through, and the calluses, emotional or otherwise, they've had to grow. Yeah. It's kind of interesting, because if you look at a person who is, you know, I remember thinking this with the lawyers when I was a young lawyer in my law firm, you know, this person is so distinguished, they're so, you know, whatever, they're so, done such good stuff, and they're so, not famous, but, you know, and then, you know, then you realize they've gone through the same dirt road that you had to go down.
Sure.
And there's a lot of scars that you don't see.
Yeah.
Scars may be too strong a word, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of...
Well, nothing came easily.
For the most part, things don't come easily.
Right. So I went into real estate, wanted to do it part-time. That didn't work out. But it worked out well. So I was always full-time. And I stayed with that company for 18 years. Mm. And then because of this lawsuit, I felt very strongly that I needed to keep more of what I was making. Mm. And there is a myth out there that when you go out on your own, you get to keep 100% of what you make. There's this thing called overhead, yeah, as you've figured out, and, you know, bricks and mortar and all that. But my intent was just to be me and go out on my own and keep everything that I made and just keep my head down and keep swimming and try to keep our boat afloat while he was pursuing this lawsuit. And then, let's see, that was in 2011, and we didn't know how long the recession was going to last.
Sure.
That was like year two or three of the recession. Went out on my own. That was terrifying. But it's such a great motivator.
Oh yeah.
when the alternative is starving.
Yeah.
And we had these four hungry children. And then, so that was in 2011. And then in 2017, I had 10 agents working for me, including myself. And I hadn't recruited any of them. It was sort of all organic by osmosis. And then Sotheby's International Realty came tapping on my shoulder. And I had no interest in talking to them. Sort of that Groucho Marx thing of why would I join a club that would have me as a member? Plus, I was doing just fine. I was doing just fine. And I thought, you know, why do I need to be part of a big corporation again? And they said, we're different. And they kept their promises. They are truly different. And they don't just... inhabit the luxury space in my industry, they own it. And they have been invaluable partners in helping us learn how to run a real estate company. One of the questions that their COO asked when we were in that sort of flirtation phase was, are you a realtor who finds herself accidentally running a real estate company? Or are you in it to win it, and do you want to build a brokerage? I was kind of like, is this multiple choice? I wasn't sure what the right answer was, but they said, we'll teach you. We'll help you build a brokerage. And so that was 2017. This is 7 years later. And we have two offices now. We have over 50 agents. Our business tripled. But the part that William left out is that he's what I call a graduate student. He already had his law degree. And when he was in law school, he flirted with the idea of getting his JD MBA. And I was like, hell no, we have no food. And now we have this baby. But it would have been just one extra year of law school. So he'd always been toying with getting his MBA. And then he did. In 2018, he embarked on that.
Yeah, that was something.
Right.
More
and
school.
Then in 2020,
it
during
was fun.
The... Oh, yeah. He thought it was fun.
It was fun.
He got his MBA in 2020, but, you know, the world had kind of shut down in terms of what he had intended to do with that. And I remember telling him that I had a dream that I had a Ferrari in my garage, like this really fast, powerful car that just stayed parked in the garage. And I realized that that was sort of a metaphor for William, that he needed to take all those smarts and apply it to the company. So he'd always been in the background and had an office in our building and all that. But then he made a formal entry into the company. So he's our in-house counsel.
Okay.
And that's highly unusual. I don't know of any other company in the upstate that has in-house counsel.
Mm-hmm. I also clean the gutters.
Yes, he does.
Me too.
So
he's
many.
He's the chief cook and bottle washer. And he's also a broker in charge for the Greenville office.
Well, the broker in charge is a role where you are legally responsible for the agents. Mm-hmm. And that's one where it's probably pretty unusual. There are plenty of other examples, but the lawyer background helps.
Yeah.
That. It sure helps.
Did y'all see that coming? Like
no.
Working together?
No, we backed into
not
it.
Not at all.
Yeah. Absolutely backed into it.
That's one of the things that, like, as we've talked to couples in this that work together, there's a lot that are like, we're going to do something together. And then there's a lot that are like, how did we end up
right.
working together?
Well, here's the way I would put it. So I had this giant lawsuit that nearly killed me. Joan supported me, and that's an understatement. I mean, she really, and there were some really dark moments in that case, and mm-hmm. she supported me, not just financially, but all that. So that was an incredible thing. And for a single lawyer to take on a case like that in retrospect, it was just really off the charts,
sure.
risky and dangerous. But, you know, I did it. And thank goodness it worked out well. And then after that, again, crazy thing, I decided to run for public office, the South Carolina Attorney General. And I did that in 2018. And again, that was Joan supporting me, supporting my decision to do that. Well, it wasn't her first choice, but I wanted to do it. No, it really wasn't.
Yeah.
But I
yeah.
wanted to do it. And I, you know, I felt like I could, it's something I could do well, and et cetera. And so I did that. So anyway, after doing that, that's kind of like, you know, it's your turn. Let me help you with whatever you need to do, mm-hmm. whatever you want to do. And so that's really what I'm trying to do in this company. It's not really, I'm really trying to help her advance the company.
Yeah.
So this isn't one of the questions I asked, but what is the ambition for your company? Like what does success look like for y'all?
I would say that we're 7 years into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you originally signed a 10-year contract with
Sotheby's.
But that's been extended to 13 years because we opened a second office. And I think long-term what we'd like to do is eventually kick ourselves upstairs
mm-hmm.
where I become this dusty figurehead.
Dusty figurehead.
Mrs. Havisham.
It's quite the ambition. Yeah. Dusty figurehead.
And we have two of our four children work for the company. Jack is strictly in management. He's a broker in charge, non-compete, and he's also in charge of agent development and recruiting.
Mm.
Grace Herlong Lovelace is the top producer in the Greenville office.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know that Grace ever wants to go into management,
mm-hmm.
but ideally we want to be able to turn the keys over
mm-hmm.
To someone, some entity at some time, but we're not in any hurry to do that because we're still building things.
Well, yeah. And I guess in answer to your question, my answer is both more specific and less specific. We spent some time last year and we came up with I guess you would call it a mission statement, and it really does, it kind of just evolved. I mean, we weren't trying to, but it was, how is it, John, to be the best?
We want to be the best brokerage for the best agents in the upstate.
Well,
I don't want to be the biggest.
Providing the best experience
for clients.
And so
right.
What my vision is that we create a company that is very agent focused, and it gives them all the support that they need to really succeed so they can grow their businesses. But it is a delightful place to work.
Mm-hmm.
And we can ideally inhabit the luxury space more and more and more, although we're very strong in that space already, but whatever spaces. But it's a great experience for agents where agents can thrive.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's my vision.
I like to say I hire really good people and then get the hell out of their way.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But our motto really is do the right thing even when no one is looking.
Mm-hmm.
So when they get sideways in a deal, if there's a client who's difficult, if there's a vendor who's difficult, if more likely the other agent on the other side is the difficulty, we'll back them 1,000%.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also very protective of our culture. I talk to a lot of agents. It's a long-term process when somebody's thinking about making a change. And a lot of agents say, well, I'm thinking about changing because I work for a company that they'll hire anybody with a pulse
mm-hmm.
and they won't fire anybody. Yeah. So they don't feel like there's a culture of anything except we're just going to milk you as long as you're here. And so I'm very protective of the culture that we've created. But the dark side of being protective is that I don't hesitate to cull the herd when they fail to do the right thing, even when no one is looking.
That's a point worth emphasizing. It's easy to talk about, you know, we have this very special culture and all this, but there are, everybody probably knows that you've run into people before who are either just toxic individuals or they really don't do the right thing or whatever. And when we've been in that situation, in fact, I've known companies, once you get a job there, it's very hard to not have that job anymore. Because, you know, letting somebody go is hard.
Sure.
Oh, it's brutal. Awful.
Even if it's well justified, it's hard to do.
Yep.
Yes.
But we're not reluctant to do it if it is merited. So like Joan said, we will defend our agents and we will really go to the mat to protect and help our agents and defend them. But at the same time, we're always going to be looking around and making sure we're doing the right thing. And if we got an agent who's not doing the right thing, they're not going to be our agent long.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good.
So what do y'all think, are there any lessons or things that y'all have learned in working together that you feel like could potentially apply to any couple working in any industry together? Any like communication style that you've adapted or support system?
Yes, we, at the behest of our son Jack, we hired a professional coach.
Okay.
About a year and a half ago. It's been about a year and a half. And at first I was like, oh, great. I'm so glad we've hired this woman because she can fix all these idiots that I'm related to. Thank God she's going to fix all these other people in my family because I am just fine. And her mantra, which is so annoying because it's accurate, is you can only fix you. You can only improve you. And if you want to use your hour with her venting about, I'm surrounded by idiots, you're wasting your time and you're also wasting your own potential. Mm-hmm. And I think that, she has led me to many, many epiphanies. Mm-hmm. You know what the seven deadly sins are? Can you name them?
I can't.
Yes, you can.
Gluttony.
Pride, lust, envy, anger, greed, gluttony, sloth. There's nothing wrong with sloth. I'm really into sloth sometimes. But
six deadly sins.
Anger is the one that is hardest for me. Mm-hmm. Particularly when you're working with family, you will speak to family and treat family and accept treatment from family in a way that you would never treat anybody else.
Chrissy tells me that a lot.
Right. She's right. But the fact is we are our best selves. Like, we are on such good behavior right now. We are our best selves.
No, you're doing great.
This is good behavior?
For others. And then we let down our guard too much within our own family. And that's not fair. And it was sort of an epiphanic thing for me very recently where I realized, sure, I can get angry. I don't have the right to. Mm. If I'm angry with you, I don't have the right to let you know that I'm angry. Hmm. I have the right and responsibility to let you know that I'm disappointed, that you can do better, that maybe I've failed you, that our communication has deteriorated. But the minute I raise my voice and say, I lose. Yeah. We lose.
This is all theoretical, y'all.
We never raise our voice.
No,
but
no,
anyway,
I see that.
We've learned so much to the point where I'm sort of an evangelist about this. If you are not being coached by someone, by something, to do your business better, then you are doing your business, you're undermining your business without even knowing it. Because like I said, I was one like, fine, and we'll hire this lame coach to make all you people. I mean, I wasn't even subtle about it. I was like, okay, fine. And now it's...
It has been. She has done a good job for us. And I think somebody holding a mirror up to you is good. You know, even if they don't but have the background.
You know that expression, you can hear it a million times, but you have to hear it from the prophet down the street.
Yep.
She's the prophet down the street. And, you know, I've gone on speaking engagements at other Sotheby's affiliates, and I'm not saying anything different from what they're trying to impart to their agents.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the prophet down the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a new face, I'm a new voice. And maybe they'll listen to it if somebody else echoes it.
Yeah.
And we had the same thing. We had a great guest speaker, Rob Allen, who came in. And that's the other part of the, you know, people think, well, I'm already a member of a network, a referral network. It is not just a referral network.
Yeah.
It is a brain trust that we are a part of with Sotheby's International Realty. And Rob Allen is the owner and CEO of Sage Sotheby's International Realty in Oklahoma City. He's 45. He is a Purple Heart veteran. And he came and he talked about his approach to doing business better. We are all sharing our best practices. And two things that he said are continuing to resonate with our people because they keep quoting him. And one of the things that he said was, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. Mm. Think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way you do anything is the way you do everything. And I think that's so true, like in tennis, because tennis is the one thing that I do that it's cheaper than therapy. And there are some terrible people on the tennis court. They're just terrible. They'll eat their young, you know?
Is that you, Chrissy?
Yeah. I play tennis as well.
Yeah.
This is a new
And but people will like to say, well, you know, she's really nice off the court. She'd give you the shirt off your back. No, it's a window into the soul. The way you play tennis is the way you are, okay?
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things he said. The way you do anything is the way you do everything. And the other thing that he said was, whatever you accept from others is the standard that you set.
That's your standard.
That's your standard. And he said, so like when he walks into his office in the morning and there's a paper cup on the sidewalk, he has to make a decision. If he picks it up, he's sending the message to himself and to everyone around, that's not okay. I don't want trash.
Mm-hmm.
But if he leaves it there, he's also making a statement of,
yeah,
that's acceptable to me. And it's not my job. It's not important enough for me to make it my job.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're running anything, a family, an organization, a company, it is never, you never get away with do as I say. It's always do as I do, whether you want it to be or not. And so I think that having this coach has really improved our family dynamic and certainly our working dynamic.
Well, there's another specific thing that comes out of the coach, which is, I think, for me at least, pretty relevant. And one of the things she says over and over, and because we are a small company, and it's Joan and myself and our son Jack, sort of, Jack's also a broker in charge with the Clemson office, and we're kind of always in each other's business.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she has said over and over is, stay in your lane.
Mm.
Stay in your lane. This is your responsibility. You worry about that. For me, let Joan and Jack worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, and vice versa. And that's a powerful lesson. And then, you know, adding to what Joan just said, the other one about, you know, you really are only responsible for you. You can only fix you. So stop going on about whatever over there. You fix yourself and you fix your reaction to whatever that other thing is, you know.
And she's right. She comes like, "Well, you need to fix them.
Yeah.
I will fix me, but you're falling down on. You need to fix them."
Like you're saying that to the coach?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have said it to her. I'm not being facetious. Like, but okay, I'll work on me, but
you work
you
on
need
them.
To fix them. And she said, "I promise you, when you fix yourself, the response that you're hoping for is going to come naturally from them."
And so if you don't mind me asking, what are some examples of ways that you're...
Let me give you an example, and it's not from this coach, but it's a story I've told my kids 1,000 times, and thinking back on it, it fits this so well.
Yeah.
This long before I knew her. It was actually in college, and I had two roommates, and one of them and I, John, we were on perfectly the same way. And we're talking about just basic cleanliness, a real simple thing.
Yeah.
And our third roommate was sort of not, you know, you make something in the, in, on the a stove and just leave the dishes out and don't wash it.
Marshall
and so
was
forth.
A pig.
He was a great guy, but he was not into cleaning the kitchen.
Set it straight.
And so what was so funny is that John and I both were so frustrated by this. And you don't want to wash somebody else's dishes. You know, that's obnoxious. You know, take care of your stuff. And then at one point, John and I sort of got together and we're like, this is on us. Marshall is never going to change. Mm-hmm. So we and we made a rule between the two of us. If we walk through the hall down and by the sink and there's a dish in it, we wash it, period. Always, every single time. And so we accepted that burden, and it completely solved the issue. Yeah, Marshall got off in a way, but it made John and me so much happy. We fixed ourselves.
Yeah.
We couldn't fix Marshall, but we fixed ourselves. That's a trivial, simple little example, mm-hmm. but, you know, when I think back on it, that's a great example of
and
what...
And Marshall was not murdered. He's alive even today, because that was the alternative.
Oh, we love Marshall. Yeah. So it wasn't about Marshall being a bad guy. He was a great guy, and, you know...
He's just
but
a pig.
He's just a pig.
Y'all might be the only college guys ever to make the decision if we're going to do dishes for
exactly.
someone else, like ever.
Exactly. No, I mean, we probably are.
Yeah. It was truly epiphanic, but the thing is... William and John are close friends even today. You know, John lives in Colorado. It was such a mature decision, and it just, it was like a cloud. I mean, trust me, their apartment was a sty. It was disgusting. And they made it a pleasant place
well,
to
be.
Well,
we fixed at least that problem. But the point is, when our coach says, Liz says, you can really only fix yourself.
Yeah.
You can't fix them. But what you do is you fix how you relate to them.
Yeah. But do you ever think about if Marshall ever got married, if his spouse is angry with y'all for enabling him?
He's like, dishes just get done.
Yeah. I can only fix myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, he's her problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, Marshall's a great guy, but he was not into doing dishes.
That's great.
But, you know, it's that's true of any relationship and, like, in business and real estate. It's... Probably the most common thing that I end up doing what I call deal doctoring about is an agent coming in saying, oh, I have a client, they're just so unreasonable and they're so unappreciative and they call me at 11 o'clock at night and blah, 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 and they're just, and they won't listen. And I'll let them vent and then I'll say, yeah, that's job security.
Yeah.
For real. If this were easy, we wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes all they need to do is vent. And the other thing that we've learned is, or at least that I've learned, it's sort of like dealing with my grown children. They'll call and they'll vent about something. I'll say, are you calling to vent or do you need my advice?
Yeah.
And especially Grace will be like, no, I don't need your advice. I know what you're going to say anyway. I'm like, all right, my work here is done.
Yeah.
But you do need to have a pressure valve.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's all you need to be.
Yeah.
Just because I mentioned something to him doesn't mean he knows now.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean he has to fix it.
That's Chrissy prefaces a lot of our conversations with, I don't want you to fix this.
Yeah, like I need comfort, not a solution.
Right, right.
Which well, we're, I mean, in the world we're in, a lot of times, you know, I'm really bad about, not bad, good. I put, depending on the point of view, you come to me and you tell me something, I'm going to try to be helpful.
Yeah.
And that I think is traditionally like a response of people that are helpful. Like you're like, let me help, let me see this in a different way. We are almost out of time, but I have one question that I want y'all to end with. So we talked about maybe some of the challenges of being married and working with your family. You'll have additional family members in this, but what would you say makes your business stronger because you are married and because you work with your family?
Well,
that's the quietest he's been all day.
Like,
I mean, honestly,
I gotta go.
I just have, you know, absolute, categorical, to the end of the world, confidence in Joan doing things the right way.
Mm.
There's never any corner cutting or, you know, we were talking about ethics and all that sort of stuff. It is jam up jelly tight. It's right down the middle of the road. So not the left side of the road, the right side of the road. It's right down the middle. And I think she feels the same way about me.
Absolutely.
And so that's something that we can absolutely forever take to the bank. And so there's no doubt under any scenario that that would always be the case. And, you know, that's not that you couldn't get it in other ways, but living and working, you know, being married to someone for all these years, You know that about each other.
Yes.
Yeah, we absolutely
Joan had a dispute years and years and years ago, and it was with another agent, and the brokers got involved, and the brokers were then talking to each other, and it was really kind of funny because one broker says to the other, he says, well, you know that Joan said such and such, and you know if Joan says it, it's absolutely true. And the other broker says, yeah, I really can't say that about my agent.
Oh, man.
He really did.
Yeah.
He really did. Wow. I don't trust my own agent.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, that gets back to protecting culture because there are people that don't ever get fired because they're top producers. Mm-hmm. And I don't care how much.
Yeah, Joan fired her top producer.
A top producer about 5 years ago. And then all these agents came out of the woodwork saying, well, this is what she did to me and this is what she did. I said, why didn't you people tell me? And they said, well, because she was a top producer. And so so I apologized to them all at the next sales meeting. And I said, this is a failure on my part that you made the assumption that cash would come before character. I can't fix something I'm unaware of.
Yeah.
So don't, you know, I didn't say, how dare you not tell me? Don't make that assumption of me.
Right.
I'm sorry if I led you to believe that I'd be like, yeah, she's dishonest, but gosh, she can sure sell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a hard and fast line that I keep.
So I would say that absolute confidence in each other is probably the one thing that I don't know how.
What else do you need?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Love that. Well, thank y'all so much for your time.
This has been really awesome.
This
was fun.
And hearing about y'all's story and kind of how you landed. And we're excited to watch y'all keep growing and
count on it.
You become to a dusty figurehead eventually.
Dusty figurehead.
That one's going in the description for sure.
I want to eventually be the 90-year-old woman who shows up and turns on off the lights because I want to keep the electric bill low.
Yeah, that's a great goal. All right, well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
This
was great.
We enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right. Bye.